we get it underway this afternoon by welcoming back to the program our friend, the very talented writer, Josh Karp, wrote the wonderful book on National Lampoon, A Futile and Stupid Gesture, has written about Orson Welles and so much more, and is working with Ricky Cobb of Super 70 Sports on some very exciting projects as well. Josh, how are you today?
I'm good. How are you, sir?
Outstanding. Yeah, you're ready to make some radio magic?
Always.
Well, you know, we don't have a lot of imagination here, so things like big round numbers, 50th anniversaries are, it's easy for us to think about, and we're 50 years out from 1972. Of course, you weren't even born then, so you just...
Oh, I was born.
Just barely.
I was a lad of six.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I wasn't... It's not like I was in college or anything like that, but I was, what was I? I was about to turn 14, I guess, back then. But either way, an interesting year, and I was looking at music and movies and television shows, and like a lot of years in the 1970s, it was the best of times and it was the worst of times.
Always. And sometimes the worst part was the best part.
Yeah. Let's start with music. Man, I looked at some of the hits from that year. There was some great music. Backstabbers by the OJs, the Rolling Stones' Tumbling Dice, Neil Young's Harvest came out that year. There was some pretty good music.
Absolutely, and there was some great weird music, right? There was Puppy Love by Donny Osmond.
And, you know, being a guy who just listened to the radio constantly during that period, and it wasn't that I hated the Osmonds specifically, that they had their appeal, but I always felt, as being about the same age as they were, I thought, Donny Osmond is the price I have to pay for the Jackson 5.
It seemed like there would be an endless number of bands like that at that time.
Oh, then the DeFranco family would come along, and oh, Lord.
Yeah, no. It was a stiff price to pay, though.
Oh, it was indeed. Yeah, Puppy Love. There were some bad ones from Donny back then. But I don't know. I'm not sure in my mind if there was much that could compare with a song that, I'm surprised Elvis didn't record, because it was in that period when he was not feeling very good about his life and his family situation. Wayne Newton's classic from that year, Daddy, Don't You Walk So Fast.
Oh, right. There was that, and there were just these weird, like, there was, I don't even know who sang this, there was a song called I'm Stone in Love with You, which is like the most 1972 title for a song.
Oh, The Stylistics, a great song.
The Stylistics, see, there you know.
I mean, anybody who can work in a lyric like, if I could, I'd like to build the first house on the moon. There would be no something and no population boom. Oh, yeah, that's brilliant.
And, of course, Mac Davis.
Oh, a lot of Mac Davis that year.
Don't
yeah.
get hooked on me.
Yeah. Also, now, I don't know, there seemed to be a clear dividing line among those who liked the song and those who never need to hear it again. It was a year that began with American Pie riding the top of the charts.
Right, which there's been no, I can't believe that song is 60 years old now. That's amazing. That's like, I probably have heard that song almost as much as any, it's like, you know, you've continually been on the radio for 60 years. That's impressive.
50 years.
We also had Schools Out for Summer that year.
Schools Out, and I remember that must have come out in the spring of that year, because I have vivid memories of my junior high school principal who was a nice man, but the old school type of principal, and it seemed to be a much older guy at the time, and all of a sudden, blasting through the speakers on the last day, he played Alice Cooper's Schools Out, and we all looked at each other like, oh my God, you know, this guy's been here for 30 years, and he's cool enough to do that. Is he drinking? No, that...
You must have been immensely relieved to not see any of you for the next 3 months.
Oh, yeah, there's no question about that. Also, one of the great musical injustices of all time in 1972, the only number one song of Chuck Berry's career.
Which was that?
My Ding-a-ling.
My Ding-a-Ling, I knew it was going to be My Ding-a-Ling. Isn't that just the injustice is the only word I think that applies. That is, wow.
But apparently from what I've read, you know, while music fans were horrified that that was the only number one, Barry loved it. Apparently loved doing it, loved the fact that it got him to number one, and sure. would perform that thing in concert even while he was in his 80s, which made it even stranger.
That's too funny. I had no idea that was his only number one. The second you said it was his only number one, I thought, oh my God, it's going to be My Ding-a-Ling.
And also, probably the only number one song about a rat, Michael Jackson's Ben.
Ben. There was a whole, that whole, like, there was all that weird kind of stuff then, you know, like, that, like, I don't think, you know, nobody sings songs about, has sung a song about a rat since, I would think, that got anywhere.
No,
you know, there was, it was a, indicative of a very strange time in our history.
And this, and I didn't know this at the time, I don't think, because apparently Casey Kasem didn't mention it, because that was where I got all my inside information at 13 years old. But
sure.
Big hit for Three Dog Night that year was actually written in celebration of the Brown versus the Board of Education decision by actor Alan Arkin's father. And that's the song Black and White.
It was written by Alan Arkin's father?
Yes.
That's fantastic. That's so good. The song I remember very, very well, but never knew that Alan Arkin's father, or that it was based on Brown versus the Board of Education.
Yeah, I mean, a couple people recorded it. Was more of a folk song, I guess, originally, but it never had much airplay anywhere. And then Three Dog Night or their producers stumbled upon it and recorded it, what, 18 years later, and it became a huge song for them.
Oh, that's fantastic. But yeah, there was a lot of good music that year. There was it's funny that one of the songs that came out that year was I Saw the Light by Todd Rundgren.
That's one of my favorite songs from the 70s.
Is one of my favorites too, and it was not until 6 months ago that I realized that it was a man singing it.
Oh, wow. Wow.
I don't know why. I always assumed it was a woman. And nothing against Todd Rundgren. I just was like always figured that the for whatever reason his voice in that song I thought was a woman, but that's a great song.
Absolutely. Oh yeah, there were some good ones mixed in. You just had to put up with some of the dreck to get there. We're talking with Josh Karp here on Downtown. Television shows too. It was some greatness out there. It was the year that MASH debuted, along with Maude, Sanford and Son, and the Bob Newhart Show.
Right. Right. Also, the After School Special, I believe, began that year.
I didn't realize that. That's awesome.
And there were endless cop shows and endless, you know, detectives. There was Banachek, as we've discussed before, Ironside, Cannon, Barnaby Jones, one of the two of the great crime fighters of all time.
Yes. was it our friend Ricky at Super 70 Sports that posted, I think last night, a picture of Barnaby Jones and William Conrad? They're side by side.
When you're looking to solve crime, you want the fattest guy and the oldest guy you can possibly find.
Right.
being a young, very, you know, being fairly young at the time, so, you know, being completely unsupervised, you know, I would watch those shows, and I couldn't begin to fathom what the story was behind Cannon.
No,
you know, I was just like, who thought he was going to be solving a crime? But they had him run.
Oh, yeah.
In the trailer for it, you know, Cannon just kind of, you know, trotting away holding a gun.
And it took me a while to figure out why Jed Clampett was talking so differently.
Right, no cement pond on Burnham.
No. I forgot this one. Oh, I got the wrong year. Never mind. I thought I had an awful one from that year, but it came out a little bit later on. Speaking of cop shows, though, and this was one of my favorites. I think we may have talked about it before, but Streets of San Francisco.
Oh, great show. Yeah. That was, to think you have, a cop show starring Carl Malden, who's like this real actor.
Yeah.
who's, I think he was part of the Actors Studio and all that. There he was, making the American Express commercials and solving crime with Michael Douglas.
And my Michael Douglas, he was young, but obviously you could see the talent that was there.
Oh, yeah, for sure. That was a great show. I think, the only year that Bridget Loves Bernie was on. Do you remember that show?
I love that show so much. Meredith, well, then she was Meredith Baxter Bernie, I think.
Yes.
Because she and David Bernie had become a real-life couple.
Right. It was, in odd ways, both very relatable and predictive for me, because, one, I grew up in a town where everybody was Jewish or Irish Catholic, like, with almost no exceptions. And that was the story of a wealthy Irish Catholic woman who marries a Jewish guy who drives a cab. And then, of course, now I'm a Jewish guy who does not drive a cab, married to an Irish Catholic. So my life has come full circle to Bridget and Bernie.
No, I like that show a lot. Another show, it was different. The Westerns were losing popularity by this time, but they dragged out old Richard Boone. Do you remember Heck Ramsey?
I remember the name. I don't remember the show itself.
Yeah, another Western show.
Gunsmoke was still on, too, I think.
Gunsmoke was, it was wheezing and coughing to the finish line there for for James Arness. Miss Kitty didn't get off the stool at the Long Branch Saloon very much at that point.
Exhausted.
And, if you were a kid in those days, Saturday mornings, to me, meant Fat Albert and the Cosby Kids.
Absolutely. It's so funny. I mean, on about 80 different levels to watch that today, right? Thinking about both Bill Cosby and the content of that show, which, you would never get away with today. Certainly.
Oh, no.
I love Fat Albert. That was a great show. And there was also, in my... because I'm doing unending research before I speak to you, I discovered the Paul Lynde show.
Oh, yes. Which, did that last more than one season?
It shockingly did not, but the description is so good. It is about Paul Lynde plays a quiet, respectable attorney right there.
Because Paul Lynde he says to you immediately, quiet, respectable attorney.
Right, exactly. I mean, whose home life has turned upside down when his daughter's new husband moves in with them. And I just thought, like, wow, that must have been, even then, how could anybody be thinking, we're going to have a married Paul Lynde, number one. And number two, that he's going to be quiet and respectable.
All I remember about that, is other than the fact that it didn't last long, is I think Stiller and Mira were semi-regulars on that show.
Really?
Yeah. I think whether they were somebody's parents, I can't remember what, but I just remember them being associated with it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I don't remember ever seeing it, but when I realized that it existed, it made me very happy.
And then Charlotte Ray was on it as well.
Right, right. I saw, yes, and Charlotte Ray as well before she became Mrs. Garrett.
We're talking with Josh Karp here on Downtown. Looking back at 1972, a year that produced great movies, that was, that whole time period, some of the best films of all time. Godfather, I mean, I know you're intimately involved and associated with Orson Welles. To me, it always comes down to Citizen Kane or The Godfather for greatest picture of all time.
Oh, absolutely. I don't know if you find this, as I get older, I don't need to pick one for sure.
Right, right.
But those two films to me really are, the greatest, kind of most, even, it's funny, I mean, like, I, even my kids can watch Citizen Kane and The Godfather and stick through it. Like, they can't stick through most other black and white movies, and they can't stick through most other movies from the early 70s unless there's just like constant action. But they, both of those movies, they love both those movies.
And both of them really set the template for everything that was to come.
Absolutely. I mean, that, you know, was it, they always say, you know, Citizen Kane was the first, you know, modern Hollywood movie. And it really, you know, what I think sustains that movie always. And The Godfather, too. I mean, I think they're both, when it comes down to it, they're these stories about what it meant to be American in the 20th century. You know, they really kind of tell the story of the country. I was talking to somebody the other day, and we were discussing how, you know, if you had to pick five people who, you know, who were just the absolute symbols of the history of the 20th century, you know, like not non-fictional people, like Howard Hughes, you know, is somebody who was part of absolutely everything that was going on, you know. But, you know, you... Citizen Kane tells, you know, the story of the kind of ambition that we still, you know, kind of see today and the corruption and things like that. And The Godfather is, you know, the story of the immigrant experience in the United States. So it's really, you know, both are just, you know, I've decided no longer to choose.
No. And what a year for Brando, who had been, struggling to find a hit for the last, I think, several years probably before that. And came out with The Godfather that year, and then also Last Tango in Paris, that we look at a little differently today based on more current information. But boy, at the time, it made Brando the hottest actor on the planet.
Right. Yeah. There won't be a remake of that for sure.
No.
Nobody's greenlighting that. But yeah, no, there was a huge year for Brando, and it was, you know, what's it called? It was a great year for, you know, comedy. You had The Ruling Class with Peter O'Toole, which is one of my favorites. Play It Again, Sam, and What's Up, Doc, which, it, of all the movies, you know, that the recently deceased Peter Bogdanovich made, that is my absolute favorite. I just, you know, can't, that is, I don't know, just it's so endlessly funny in this really ridiculous and silly way. It's like, it's the perfect... Whatever anyone thinks of Barbara Streisand, she's just undeniably great.
Absolutely. I mean, another film, I don't know how I got in to see this because I wasn't old enough, but they weren't checking IDs back in those days. And I remember being absolutely flummoxed in so many ways by seeing Deliverance.
Oh, that, I mean, I probably saw that like 3 years later, maybe when I was like nine.
Whoa.
On TV. Yeah, made a big impression.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I never wanted to go either to the South or on water again.
Right. That movie, it's funny, I mean, how much that movie has affected people, you know, I would say, what, above, you know, the age of 45. You know, we all, everybody's just like, oh yeah, it's Deliverance. Wow.
No, like, I met Ned Beatty once. This was back in the 80s, and met him at a radio station, and talked to him about what a fan I was of his career, and mentioned this, that, and the other thing. And when I got to Deliverance, he goes, "You want to know something funny?" I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "Squeal Like a Pig, my idea."
Really?
I said, "Really?" He goes, "That." What I added to it was not not really in the script. And he said, "Now that's going to be the first line in my obituary."
I read, there's a book about the making of Network. And, you know, he has that fabulous scene in Network where he gives Peter Finch the lecture about how the world operates. And he literally showed up that day, shot that scene, and left. That was his only, you know, involvement, and it was a one-day deal, and they just said, "Here's who you are, here are the lines," and he did it. And it's, I mean, it's unbelievable, because one of, I consider, you know, one of my favorite scenes in any movie ever made.
Because
he is a great great, great act.
Because you're on TV, dummy. It was also, now there had been other disaster films, but the one that really sent the genre into high gear, A Poseidon Adventure.
Right. Right. That was, yeah, I was just, it's funny. I was discussing this with somebody literally 2 days ago. We were discussing how that was the beginning of, and I think it's hard for, you know, people to probably appreciate now, but I mean, you had like these disaster movies where gigantic stars were in them.
Right, right. And I think Airport kind of started that, right?
If you made a movie about the Bermuda Triangle and the stars were like Denzel Washington, you know, and like Gary Oldman, and, you know, I can't even think of, but Paul Newman, Steve McQueen, you know, the cast for The Towering Inferno was Paul Newman, Steve McQueen, and William Holden.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that's before you got the Fred Astaire and all.
Right, and there was a certain Love Boat quality to it as well, because you'd see people that, as our old friend Gilbert Gottfried used to say, that you thought were dead, and there they were and still able to do the job.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. That's wow. Yeah, that God, that's so sad about Gilbert. What a great. Did you ever have him on the show?
We did, and he was wonderful, and he used that phrase in talking about his podcast. He said we would go through lists of people we wanted on the show, and we would find them and be surprised they were still alive, and then reach out to them. But they ended up being great guests because they had all these wonderful stories.
Right? No, they had what, like Pat McCormick was on all the time. I mean, they really, you know, found the great old showbiz.
Oh yeah, and he was such a fan and so knowledgeable of especially early television. As much as I always enjoyed his stand-up comedy, listening to him on his podcast was, I think, my favorite bit of work that he did through the years, because you got to see more of the real Gilbert.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. No, he was. That show was just amazing. I you know, you talk about old TV. I read somewhere online that when he was ill, he was at the doctor and they wanted to have him do math to test his brain function. And he said, "I won't do math, but I'll sing the theme song to Car 54, Where Are You?"
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's like that's the way to go.
Exactly, exactly. All right, what's the update? What's going on with you and Ricky Cobb? Where are we on the projects?
Well, Ricky and I are in the middle of we're about to be out pitching our 70s themed animated series. So we're hoping to get something done on that pretty soon. We are doing have you ever had Mike Gerber on?
No.
Your show? He publishes a magazine called The American Bystander, which is kind of old-fashioned humor magazine.
I love it.
Yeah, oh, it's great. And he does it with Brian McConaughey, who
From Lampoon.
Who's, I think, the only guy who wrote for the Lampoon, SNL, and SCTV. He's the strange trifecta, but he's the guy. And he features a lot of really good people, and like Meryl Marco writes for him sometimes from the original Letterman show. And anyway, we're working on a special Super 70s edition of that magazine that's going to come out at the end of the summer.
Well, that's fantastic.
Yeah, and we're still pitching around the 70s encyclopedia, and kind of amazed that we have not found a home for it yet, but we will.
Excellent. Well, we look forward to all that. Always enjoy talking with you, Josh. Thanks for squeezing us in this afternoon, and we'll catch up with you again.
Thank you for having me on. I enjoyed it.
All right. We'll see you this summer sometime. We'll get together again.
Sounds good. Have a great weekend.